What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We are joined this morning by Kelly Waldron, a data reporter for Mission Local in San Francisco, and Frankie Solinsky-Durea, who writes about immigration, also for Mission Local. They wrote a recent article, 2,123 Lives Inside the Stats and Stories of Those Arrested by ICE from the San Francisco Area. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thank you
morning,
so much.
Good morning,
Kat. Thanks for joining us. Frankie, I get your last name right?
Yeah.
Okay. Right on. All right. I usually start with the stories. So, Frankie, be on standby because I actually want to begin with the numbers today. And Kelly, I believe I direct those to you. But, Frankie,
that's
feel
right.
Free to jump in whenever you need to. Kelly, let's start with the time period you all looked at in terms of ICE activity in the Bay Area, as well as what buckets of activity you were tracking.
So this project started because we came across data from the Deportation Data Project, which is a research collaborative run out of UC Berkeley led by a law professor called David Houseman. And they have been filing records requests to obtain information about ICE activity across the country. And the latest data release that we had at the time went up until June 26th. So we looked at data from January 20th to June 26th, so from the new federal administration onwards. And we specifically looked at three different data sets on arrests, detentions, and deportations. And in this project, essentially, we stitched those together because the data is anonymized, but it has very detailed information about each person who was arrested and where they were detained and eventually where they were deported to. So, while the data was anonymous, we were able to find unique identifiers and stitch those across the data sets and essentially look them up each time and trace each person's journey through the system to gain a better understanding of, where people were going and kind of the journey from arrest to deportation. Because up until that time, we'd only been documenting arrests in San Francisco on the ground and didn't have a very comprehensive view of the full scale of what was happening locally.
One of my takeaways from this, right, because, you know, I track at least resistance to some of this stuff, is that ICE has been super active here and across the state since January, not just since June, when they descended upon Los Angeles and the people took to the streets to resist, sparking this national resistance to fight. Is that inaccurate? So they were sort of like moving
yes.
underground quietly, yeah?
Right. Yes, that's completely accurate. In the time frame we looked at, so the give or take the 6 month period we analyzed, the total number of arrests in the San Francisco area of responsibility doubled compared to the same period last year. So things were ramping up for a while. They certainly peaked in May, around May, June. I forget which week specifically in May, but around that time. So we have seen the, enforcement change from the beginning of this year, essentially. There were a total of 2,123 arrests in the San Francisco area. That's quite a broad jurisdiction. The ICE jurisdictions cover broad areas that includes most of Northern California, Hawaii, Guam, and Saipan, so some Pacific Islands. But that is the most granular information we have. And the vast majority of those are in California.
I see you shaking your head, Frankie. Is there anything you want to add there?
No, I think Kelly is saying everything exactly right. The one thing I would note that we saw in our data and other newsrooms have also reported on this is that even though there has been this general trend of ICE detentions going on, all these arrests happening since January, in this late May, early June period, one thing that we saw spike was the number of people who were being arrested without any sort of criminal conviction or pending charge. It was at this point where the number of people being arrested as they normally had been kind of continued rising. And then the number of people being arrested just on immigration violations really just completely skyrocketed.
That's a good segue to my next question, which actually is for you, Frankie, because I want to start walking through some stories. One of the things that Shocked is just the wrong word. I don't think anything these days shocks me right now. But I'm wondering if y'all figured out how they, because these people seem just random people living their lives. To your point, there's like no big criminal incident, right? There's the so like if you talk about Edwin Eduardo Castaneda, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's just a dude with his, has a baby and a wife, yeah. And he's living his life, and they just, not even at his house, right? He's out in the world. You're about to tell the story. I should stop telling the story. And they grab him. And that for me was like, what kind of surveillance are you using? Like, what are the systems in place to find these average, ordinary human beings? I'm going to turn it over to you, Frankie, to talk about, or is it Edwin or Edeen?
Edeen, but I think his family refers to Miss Eduardo.
Oh.
No, but that is a fantastic question. I think for those who haven't read the story, Eduardo was picked up on his way to work, which in the Bay Area is something more uncommon, or at least less reported on, where he was driving to Redwood City for his job. He stopped for breakfast. When he stopped for breakfast, that is when he was picked up. And I think your question of how are they targeting people is exactly what we are trying to figure out and what immigration activists across the country are trying to figure out. There's no particular rhyme or reason that can be figured out. There was a long period of time where they were going for people who had only come recently, and then that seemed to change. The one thing that we do know is that in the Bay Area, the majority of these arrests are happening at the immigration courthouse or at ICE check-ins. So these are people who are complying with the law and showing up for their regularly scheduled hearings. And we've seen fewer on the street ICE arrests in San Francisco and the greater Bay Area. But we are seeing more as time goes on.
I'm going to digress before I continue on, because I actually mm-hmm. sort of skipped over this and I was just interested. It's called the San Francisco Area of Responsibility, but it doesn't just cover California, right?
That's right. Yeah. It covers Northern California and Hawaii, Guam, and Saipan.
All right. I just, when people hear the term, I want them to understand what we're actually talking about. You answered this question, Kelly, but I want you to say it again because I think it's important. And that's the journeys that you tracked, right? Like from point of arrest to where people go. And then if you could talk about the numbers of like who remained in detention, who was really, you know, you see where I'm going with this.
Certainly, yeah. So as I mentioned, this was a big part of this piece is, you know, stitching together this information with the data we had available. We were able to track the 193 people who were arrested locally. So that's in that broad ICE jurisdiction that covers Northern California and the Pacific Islands. Of those, we found 2,057 of those people, they showed up in the detention record. So we had records of them being detained. For most people, the average is, you know, 3 detention stays. So typically, you know, immigrants are transferred from one facility to another. You know, one good example is, as Frankie mentioned, we've been seeing many arrests at the ICE field office in downtown San Francisco. There's also a holding room, which is a short-term detention facility in the same building. So we found, 400 people were detained there in that time. And typically they'll be moved to a longer term facility. There's a couple around Bakersfield and kind of a couple of hours away from San Francisco. And then, but we also found that many people were sent to detention facilities across the country. Many people were sent to Arizona. The majority of people were deported from the country via the San Ysidro border near San Diego. But I think the second most common point of departure was the Louisiana airport. And then of those, you know, we kind of were fixed on this January to June timeframe. As of the time the data was extracted, something like 689 people were still in detention and around 1,200 had been deported, and the vast majority of those people went to countries in Latin America, Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
And just a reminder for the listeners, we just heard in the news headlines that folks aren't always being sent to the countries, their countries of origin, that Trump is now making deals with countries, you know, across the globe to send people to places they've never been. Frankie, what happens to Adin once Eduardo he's deported? Where is he at now?
Yeah, so Eduardo, we should say, just tracking the journeys that everyone is following, he has a sort, in many ways, typical journey, or at least it's one that's emblematic of what we generally saw, which is that he was taken to Bakersfield, which is where many of the California detention centers are. Taken to Fresno, I believe. And then sent to Arizona, sent to a third state that he was never told where he landed, just for a layover, and finally sent to Louisiana. And from there, he was deported to Guatemala City. And in Guatemala City, he is living his life as best he can. But at least the last time that we spoke, and the last time I spoke with his wife, he is there, and his kids and his wife continue to be in the Bay Area. And they intend to visit him, but he's doing everything he can to try and rebuild a life there that he didn't have for a while.
And has no, I mean, you know, there's no sort of how to, right? So I grew up where I grew up. I know how to navigate where I grew up. I understand the systems, et cetera. He's starting all over. I'm watching the clock tick, and I do want to give you a chance, Frankie, quickly to talk about Aníbal Mauricio Martínez Bolinas. What happened to him?
Oh, yeah. So I should say Aníbal, and I think he's a fascinating person to look at because he goes by Michael, and because he's lived in the United States since he was 9. And so despite his long El Salvadorian name, all of his friends know him by Michael. It's like a video gamer online with a bunch of these other like college age people, whatever. Just a, I think, very sad person to have been targeted. He was deported within 24 hours, which is less common in the data that we've seen, but I think is important to note in that there are many people in our data set who are between arrest and deportation only within that system for 7 days in many cases. And so there's this really fast-tracked process that they've been running, which is expedited removal also, that we've done a good amount of reporting on, where people are just being ejected from the country very quickly. And so now he's back in El Salvador in his hometown trying to find a job. And he hasn't been there since he was 9.
But maybe this is for Kelly, because I did want to touch on that before we say goodbye. That is the speed with which people are moving through the system now. Do you have comparison to before, what, BT and AT, in terms of what's happening? And then what concerns do the civil rights attorneys that you spoke to have about the speed's impact on due process?
I can speak to the numbers we have. We don't have a reference to the previous time period, but I can say that, as Frankie mentioned, many people move through the system very quickly. The half of those who we identified in our data set were in ICE custody from start to finish for fewer than 6 days. So, you know, that is very fast, particularly considering how most of those people will have moved several times within that time frame. And that there is great variation. There are many people who stayed longer term. We're not sure why that is exactly. There were 270 people who had been in detention for more than 30 days. Many remained in detention at the time of us reporting this story. I'll let Frankie speak to the kind of impact of this or what this means.
Yeah, we have seen civil rights attorneys definitely concerned. As Kelly has said, everyone is transferred to faraway locations. And I think something that we often see from lawyers is that it's much, much harder to talk with their clients once they're out of state. And so in San Francisco, one thing that we have been seeing many lawyers do is habeas petitions to get their clients out, which is one of the few options. And our colleague, Margaret Kadif, has reported on them. But once people are out of state, and obviously if they're out of the country, it immediately becomes so, so hard to do anything. And so this increased speed is just really compressing the time frame in which lawyers are able to intervene in any way.
What is next? You all have been reporting on this issue. What's the next bucket that you all are looking at?
Well, we have reporters every week going to the local ICE field office and the immigration courthouse, both in downtown San Francisco, documenting arrests as they happen. Frank, you mentioned our colleague Margaret Kadiva, who's been doing excellent work on that. I think we're just going to keep continuing doing that and see how things change. The Deportation Data Project was the group that made this data set available to us and then the public. The last two releases this summer that they published, both of those came from litigation. They had to sue ICE in order to get this data. But we've been receiving more, so I'm continuing to look at it and identify any changing trends. As Frankie mentioned, we've also been looking at how the, and other outlets have reported on this too, how the number of people who have no criminal convictions, that number keeps going up. More people are getting arrested, and those people don't have any criminal background. So yeah, that's what we're focused on.
This is such important work. Thank you so much for doing it. And feel free to reach out whenever we need to get what you're reporting on into the world. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.